The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
Hey you, happy Friday. This is The Takeaway for September 2nd, 2016. Remember, you're a part of our show. Record a voice memo from your smartphone and send your comment to takeawaydigital@gmail.com. Have a great weekend.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks so much for listening. And we start this hour with a story of reconciliation in Washington, D.C. Back in 1838, two of the nation's most prominent Jesuit priests sold off 272 men, women, and children to pay down debts so that Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. could survive.
Ensuring our history is alive to us, we must acknowledge that Georgetown University participated in the institution of slavery.
That was Georgetown President John J. DeJoy yesterday publicly announcing that the institution will make amends to the descendants of slaves who were sold off almost two centuries ago. DeJoy offered a formal apology. He also said the university will offer descendants of those slaves preferential treatment in the admissions process. It's going to be similar to what's given to children of alumni or legacy applicants now. The university will also create an institute for the study of slavery, and it's going to rename two halls that are now named for those Jesuit priests, and will also develop a public memorial to slaves who worked on the campus. In recent years, a lot of high-profile institutions have publicly acknowledge their historical connections with the slave trade. Georgetown, though, has gone further. Craig Stephen Wilder has written broadly about the intersection of slavery and American capitalism. He's professor of history at MIT and author of numerous publications, including the book Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. I'm also joined by Maxine Crump. She is a direct descendant of the slaves that were sold by Georgetown in 1838. She lives in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and is president and CEO of the nonprofit Dialogue on Race, Louisiana. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Maxine Crump, how long have you known that you were a descendant of slaves who were sold by Georgetown? And what was your reaction to this news from the university?
I've known since January of this year. And I was told by Richard Cellini of the Georgetown Memory Project, a group of alums who formed this organization. And I received a phone call and I didn't get it, and there was a message left. And when I called back, I missed him. Finally, when he called back, I was driving toward Marengwen at the time, which is the hometown that I grew up in, where the plantation was, West Oak Plantation. When I got that phone call, when he said the name Cornelius Hawkins, it stood out to me right away that there was something real about this because, and the reason I even have to think about whether it was real is because as African Americans, we thought that we would never find that far back into slavery, our direct connection, because that they were so scattered and that sort of thing. Knew nothing about slaves being beyond the South, knew nothing about thinking about researching it. So when I get this call, I am just overcome in the sense of not emotionally overcome, but just everything in me just stood still. It was such a moment that I wanted to be in. My car was moving, but I felt like I was standing still and just allowed it to all download inside of me because it answered so many questions. I felt like new doors were open in my life.
As you reached back into the past, and the connection, Maxine Crump, does make some sense because we should point out that when these 272 slaves were sold by Georgetown, they were sold from plantations in Maryland right down to Louisiana, where you live today.
Right. And like I said, I didn't even know they had slaves in Maryland. I thought they were all in the South. And it answered another question I had asked one of my cousins, who was Cornelius's grandson. I'm Cornelius's great-great-granddaughter. This was Cornelius's grandson. And I asked him, where did his father come from, which is my grandfather? And he said, I think Boston. So I stopped asking right there because he was 91, and I thought, yeah, he can't be right. I said, how did he get here then? You know, but I could tell. I just felt like not to even ask him anymore because that just didn't sound right. I wish I had now.
Craig Stephen Wilder, Georgetown isn't the only American university with ties to slavery, as we mentioned, and you've written about this. This includes Harvard, the University of Virginia, even Brown University in Rhode Island, which is in the north. But what Georgetown has done here is a first in some ways.
Yeah, there are things that in the Georgetown report and the decisions that were made public yesterday that are unique among the institutions that are dealing with this problem. A lot of the report actually repeats actions that have been taken on other campuses, but Georgetown actually takes a couple of steps that go further. One is actually treating the descendants of the people sold in 1838 as giving them special status in the admissions process.
Special status, but no financial aid, no extra help affording going to the school. And a lot of people have said that even though they've gone farther than other schools, they could have done more.
This is a very low bar. Yeah, going farther than other schools actually doesn't tell you very much. Most schools have done actually very little. And when you think about the extent of the issue, every American college established before the American Revolution has direct ties to slavery and the slave trade. And one of the things that's stunning is how few institutions have actually taken significant steps to publish this history, deal with it, and respond to it.
So what's the history at Georgetown that's relevant here? I mentioned the two presidents of the university, the Jesuit priests, sold on these slaves to get money. It was as simple as that. But what's the deeper history here?
The deeper history is Georgetown is established in 1789, the same year that George Washington is inaugurated and the Constitution is finally ratified. And so you actually have this really quite extraordinary historical moment. That's not an accident. Georgetown, the priest of the United States, who are largely in Maryland. Maryland is the Catholic colony that becomes the sort of headquarters of the Catholic Church in the aftermath of the war. Anti-Catholicism has died down some after the American Revolution because of the significant help that we get from the French and the Spanish. And so really what you have is actually the leaders of the Catholic Church in Maryland begin to plan out the development of their church in the new United States. And that development is actually going to rest on slavery. In fact, actually, the place that they gather to talk about building the church is one of the slave plantations in Maryland. And so they're actually sitting on a slave plantation talking about the future of the church. And Georgetown is going to be one of the first major institutions. Georgetown is going to be the Catholic Church's claim to the United States. It's going to it's a chance to institutionalize Catholicism in the new nation and protect a church that had actually been quite sort of violently at times oppressed in the colonial period. And so Georgetown's relationship to slavery begins in 1789 when it's founded. There are slaves on the campus. The faculty use slaves. The officers use slaves. There's the vice president of the college in the original rule book is in charge of supervising the servants on the college ground.
Students brought slaves with them if they had the money to own them.
At many colleges they do, and it seems, they bring this is something that goes all the way back to schools like William and Mary in Virginia, where, when Thomas Jefferson is there in the 1760s, about 10% of the boys in his class, the young men in his class, bring slaves to campus with them.
Maxine Crump, you and I are learning maybe a lot of this history together. I'm sure you've learned it in the report over the last several months, but it's really coming alive here in a way that maybe you didn't expect. I know that when you got this call, it was a big shock and a big download for you, as you said, but all of this history that we're hearing about, how does that affect you?
It has a tremendous effect. And when I think about the pain of my descendants and the fact that I'm really glad that the hall is going to be named Isaac Hawkins Hall, the hall that once was bared my lady's name, and that's my great-great-great-great-grandfather. Not too many people of slave descendants know that far back into slavery, their relatives. Right. I just hope that Georgetown really does keep its word, and I believe it will, to make this history come alive in America and to support other institutions for coming forward. It's just very exciting to me to know that this pain is going to be brought forward and that we can be forthright and honest about our history.
Craig Stephen Wilder, the window that this move by Georgetown has opened up for us, some of it you've described, not only august institutions financed and operated with slave labor, but also an American economy based on the cotton business and slave labor. What Georgetown has done here is a step. It opens up the inevitable conversation about reparations. And I wonder if they haven't offered money or financial aid to descendants of slaves, because that would open up a conversation about reparations that people don't want to have.
I think on a lot of campuses, what you've seen is an attempt to avoid this history, in part because we're trying to escape the conversation about reparations. I think this is inconsistent with who we are as academics and as academic institutions. We actually make a commitment. We're founded on a mission to pursue truth and to pursue knowledge. We can't stop pursuing knowledge and pursuing truths when those truths arrive at our front door. I think part of what Georgetown is looking at, like many institutions, is that the event in 1838 that has led Georgetown to this moment is not the end of its history with slavery. It's actually only the beginning of its history with slavery. There's a
Absolutely.
Much bigger story beneath there.
Maxine Crump.
Yes. I think that a lot of people fear reparation, and then there are those who don't want reparation, who believe that reparation might end up where the United States will say, okay, if we pay them off, then we're done with it. Let's not talk about this anymore. If reparations would mean that institutions like Georgetown and many others would work to assure equal status for all descendants of slaves, because we do not have equal status. We have equal rights, but that's not equal status. We're not treated as the real Americans. We're treated as Black Americans or African Americans. And you hear the term African American community. Well, where is the white American community? That's just considered America. So it definitely means that we're not the same status if our community has to have a separate name. And there isn't an our community in my mind. From the time I was 7 years old, I remember my dad explaining to me that I was a full American. And I have understood that, but I have also understood that just because I think that doesn't mean that's how the country treats those who are descendants of slaves like me.
I want to thank Maxine Crump, a direct descendant of a slave who was sold by Georgetown University, and president and CEO of the nonprofit Dialogue on Race Louisiana, and also Craig Stephen Wilder, professor from MIT and author of numerous books, including Ebony and Ivy, Race and Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
My name is Gerald Jones. I'm calling from Dallas, Texas. And as an African American, I strongly believe that we are long overdue for reparations. However, not solely in the form of a monetary amount. Everything our ancestors were deprived of should be considered for reparations. Free DNA tests to find our origin, low-cost college tuition, and automatic voter registration at the age of 18 for depriving our ancestors of voting rights.
We've been asking you, how should the government and universities handle this part of our history?
Hi, this is Cricket Lusco. I'm calling from Forest Grove, Oregon. I think we need to handle this with absolute bald-faced honesty, no sugarcoating, and free genetic testing for anyone who believes they may be a descendant of slaves. Anyone determined to be a descendant of slaves should receive reduced prices on housing and education.
And we got this from Gonzalez in Florida. It is the responsibility of African Americans to realize their own potential without asking for the government to make up for the wrongdoings of people who have long since been dead. We will never rise over slavery and racism if we pretend it is the single most powerful reason for the failures of African Americans in America. I know best. I am an African American. No one ever gave me anything. Call us. Get in on this conversation. 877-8-MY-TAKE is the number. You can always leave a comment at the website at thetakeaway.org. Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. If you've heard anything about Kickstarter or GoFundMe, you know that thanks to the internet, you can crowdfund almost anything: unexpected health costs, indie movies, a new gadget. Well, you can also crowdfund lawsuits. It's called litigation finance. And as a business, it's nothing new. The idea is you front some money to help someone pay for the court costs of a lawsuit. And then if the party wins, you get a slice of those earnings. It's usually a play, though, for big corporate investors. But now, Silicon Valley is getting in on the action, and some of these litigation finance companies are letting the public invest in court cases for the very first time. Maya Steinitz is a law professor at the University of Iowa who studies litigation finance. Maya, welcome.
Hello.
So how does litigation finance work, maybe not for big companies that do it, but for the rest of us?
Well, right now it doesn't really work for the rest of us unless someone has a personal injury claim. That's a market of legal claims that's been receiving funding for quite some time. And other than that, big businesses have been able to receive funding.
Well, now some of these startups online are allowing, sort of democratizing this process a little bit, right? You don't have to be a corporate investor to get in on this.
You don't have to be a corporate investor, and you don't have to, if you're a claimant, you don't have to have a very, very large claim that someone will be willing to spend a lot of money trying to vet and see if it's a good investment. So it's democratizing it and on both ends, who can invest in it and what kind of claims can be financed.
So what kind of payoffs are possible here? Let's just pretend I'm a person with some money I want to invest, and I go on a website that kind of vets these lawsuits, uses algorithms to tell me, you know, who the lawyers are, who the judges are, what the claim is like. What's a realistic amount for me to put down to make a bet here?
Well, the most important thing to emphasize here is a bet. Lawsuits are a very speculative business. This is what is called in finance an alternative asset, which means it's very high risk. So I think that the public should proceed with great caution, understanding that it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to actually do any kind of projection on what kind of return is to be expected. So my main advice, not that I'm giving investment advice, is to proceed with great caution.
Yeah, naturally. I think we're trying to get an idea of what this universe is like. Let's say, you know, I've got your advice, Maya Steinitz. I know it's risky. I'm going to do it anyway. Let's talk about the realistic world. What do I got, $5,000, $10,000 I want to put down? What's realistic here?
What's realistic is really a very, very broad range. It can be zero, and it could be a lot of money.
So this can sky's the limit. You know, people are comparing this, of course, to Peter Thiel, the PayPal founder, and his funding of the lawsuit that sunk Gawker on behalf of Hulk Hogan. Is this that? This is something a little different than a billionaire swooping in to fund a high-profile lawsuit.
It's very different, among other things, because the investor through these new platforms doesn't really know the case. They're not actually reading the pleadings, getting to know the witnesses, especially getting to know the lawyers who are pursuing the case, because a lot of the success or failure depends on whether the lawyering is good or not. So it's completely different. It's actually the other end of it. It's a complete speculation on whether it is a winning case or not.
And do we know whether these websites that are essentially middlemen now between potential bettors, investors I'll call them, and litigants are effective in kind of gauging the chances of the investment? They sort of look at the lawyers involved. Like I said, they look at the judges. They look at different aspects of the claim. How good is that as a predictor?
We don't know. There's no track record for this. I personally am very skeptical that it's possible to put a price on legal claims because there's so much human factor that goes into it. Is the judge going to pass away and be replaced in the middle? Who's going to be the jury? There's just too many human variables. So I'm personally skeptical that it's even a possible enterprise. But certainly we don't know yet anything about the platforms. And the most important thing is it's not regulated. So if the platforms themselves, the middlemen, are not required to have what's called skin in the game, namely to hold on to some of the risk in every investment, they also don't have an economic incentive necessarily to do a good job of vetting. They have an interest in getting a good reputation, but they get paid by fees, presumably, whether or not an investment in a case is successful.
Which means the incentive for them may rely in a churn, getting as many people to bet as possible, not necessarily the quality of the bets.
That's definitely a risk that is out there.
Well, there's also a long history, you know, of activism when it comes to funding lawsuits. Certainly in the civil rights realm, we've seen many, many cases throughout our history where groups outside of a lawsuit will want to fund a lawsuit because they have a social mission or a political mission. This is a little bit different than that, but I wonder if within this there isn't an opportunity for activism on the part of the littler guy who's not executive director of a civil rights organization. Is there a chance for that, or is it all injury claims and just sort of more churny stuff?
There is a chance for that. The very first crowdfunded case that I'm aware of that was the subject of a symposium in California a while back was by an entrepreneurial solo lawyer who brought a kind of human rights case. And he just turned to the public and he didn't present it as an investment opportunity, but as an opportunity to do something good. And so I think that the potential is very broad. Finance generally is a utility. It helps us do other things. And it can be used and it can be abused.
Corporate investors have known for a long time that they can invest big money in big lawsuits, take high risks, and maybe come away with big payoffs if judges and juries go their way. That's getting somewhat democratized now, of course, thanks to the internet. You can't be the little guy, but smaller people, maybe with a little bit less skin in the game, can invest in lawsuits too. High risk, potentially high reward, but I emphasize again, like Maya Steinitz does, high risk. She's a law professor at the University of Iowa studying litigation finance. Maya, thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick filling in for John Hockenberry today. President Barack Obama continues a 10-day trip today. He kicked off his Asia swing in his home state of Hawaii, advocating for land and ocean conservation.
No nation, not even one as powerful as the United States, is immune from a changing climate. I saw it myself last year in our northernmost state of Alaska, where the sea is already swallowing villages and eating away at shorelines, where the permafrost thaws and the tundra is burning, where glaciers are melting at a pace unprecedented in modern times. And it was a preview of our future if the climate keeps changing faster than our efforts to address it.
Now, President Obama's trip culminates at the G20 summit in Hangzhou, China, on September 4th. Before the summit, President Obama meets with China's President Xi Jinping tomorrow. It's expected that both the U.S. and China will cement their commitments to the Paris Global Climate Agreement from last year. Now, President Obama wants this climate deal to be a key part of his legacy as his presidency winds down. The truth is that we can't do it without the Chinese. David Biello is here. He's science curator for TED Talks and is a contributing editor to Scientific American. David, thanks for being here.
No problem.
Well, how important is it now for the United States and China to ratify the Paris Agreement? Why does that count right now?
It's extremely important because they are the two largest polluters in the world. If China and the U.S. don't act, then it doesn't really matter what anybody else does. We're responsible for roughly 40% of global pollution causing climate change.
And also in terms of the actual dynamics of the agreement, that there are triggers here, like the largest polluters have to agree before the whole thing kicks in, right?
Correct. 55 countries representing 55% of global pollution have to agree to the agreement before it can take force. Obviously, we'd be a long way there if 40% of global emissions from these two countries kicked in.
So the two largest polluters, there's the rules of the agreement itself. Is it fair to call this sort of the starting gun, really, to the practical application of Paris?
I think that's extremely fair to say. So far, the ratifiers have been smaller countries, those who are on the front lines of a changing climate, like small island states. These would be the first big countries to sign on. And interestingly enough, in recent days, India also signaled its willingness to sign on to its Paris commitments.
Another large polluter along with the U.S. and China. So what's left to be done in the Paris Agreement that's not accomplished? There was a great deal when this was widely reported by us and everybody else, a lot of discussion about what this agreement can accomplish, but also how it fell short. It wasn't enforceable. It was basically enforceable by a public shame factor that if you were a polluter, other countries would know it and you would be sort of shamed into action. So what's left to be done on the practical side to get agreements like the one we may see this week into major reductions?
It's to actually do it. So the U.S. is about halfway to its goal of at least a 26% drop in pollution by 2025. Good news from China is that their emissions may have peaked, but they have promised, assuming they agree, to peak their pollution by 2030. The practical steps are actually implementing those moves. Now, yes, they are not enough on their own to halt climate change in its tracks, but they are the first steps that we're making as a global community to restrain climate change pollution.
And how far has China gone to actually cut? They've made several agreements. They seem to be changing policy to adapt to climate change, but they've been rapidly growing, of course, their population, but also building coal-fired power plants still at an alarming clip when you look at the statistics.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. But they are burning less coal, which is the most important thing. So these new coal-fired power plants that they're building are actually more efficient than the many smaller, less efficient coal-fired power plants that they used to have. They're also building more nuclear power plants than anybody else. They're building more wind farms than anybody else. And they're building more solar panels than anybody else. Now, China relies on coal, and getting them off the coal habit is kind of the whole thing with climate change.
And they're buying a lot more cars than they used to.
Exactly.
Which is also important, although not as important as what they call the point source. The power plants are the big sources, right?
Exactly. Coal-fired power plants are the number one source all around the world.
So countries have agreed to this. President Obama goes to China, high-profile handshake with the president there. There is a factor here in the United States' future, which is that Donald Trump could get elected president. Now, if you're the Chinese and you're making this agreement with the United States at this point, how do you view the potential that one of the candidates says they would tear up these agreements and renegotiate? How does that go into the calculation?
I think the Chinese are going to do what they want to do regardless of who our president is. And the Chinese want to cut pollution for their own health, frankly. Combating climate change is going to help reduce the haze and smog that they're coping with. And it really is a huge public health threat in China. It is a social security threat for the Communist Party. They want to retain power. This is one of the main threats to their power. They're going to act on climate change regardless of what we do. However, if we give them an excuse to kind of lay back or go slower, they probably will take that.
Because both of these countries do that. I mean, you hear in this country all the time, it's not worth us taking risks for our economy if the Chinese aren't following suit, if the Indians aren't following suit.
Exactly. And it's the same over there.
China has a terrible particulate pollution problem, which is separate from carbon and climate change. But you're saying that these two things kind of go hand in hand.
The two things go hand in hand because that particulate problem comes from those same coal-fired power plants.
So you reduce one, you reduce the other.
Exactly.
Sort of two for one. So how important is this, though, in the overall U.S.-China relationship? These relationships are complicated and multifactorial. They have parallel tracks. We all know that. But we're seeing other tracks where there are major disagreements between the U.S. and China. China's militarization of the South China Sea is a major flashpoint. So we're cooperating in this area, and I wonder how that helps in the overall relationship.
Well, I think this is one of the few areas where the U.S. and China, at least currently, completely agree. We both want to act on climate change, and that helps build goodwill and friendship between the two countries. And the truth is, if we both act on climate change, we're a long way towards solving the problem.
And for the desire for President Obama to have this as a major part of his legacy, I mean, how long into the future before the historians are writing about this will we have to go to know if this really was a positive part of his legacy, if it worked out to mean anything?
I think we'll find out in about 2025.
That long?
Yeah. That's when we'll know whether the U.S. hit its targets. You know, Barack Obama failed to pass climate legislation early in his presidency. This is his chance to make some of that ground back.
President Obama on a final swing visiting China. He's there for the G20 summit, also to cement a major climate agreement between China and the United States. David Biello, science curator for TED Talks, contributing editor for Scientific American. Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ or curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. More at curious.com/PRI. The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Greetings and salutations. Welcome to the emergency line of the San Angeles Police Department. If you prefer an automated response, press 1 now.
No guns, no foul language, no red meat. land of the free.
Dallas Multipass.
You know how it is. Bump into each other, sparks happen. Anyway, we're in love.
It's Friday when we talk about the weekend's movie releases here on The Takeaway. And as usual, here to help with all your weekend movie needs, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Hi, Rafer.
Hi, Todd.
Great to have you back. I hope you had some good time in the summer.
I did indeed, out in Michigan. Very beautiful.
Fantastic. Michigan, that's great. Well, we've got two films on tap today. We're going to talk about Morgan from director Luke Scott. We're also going to talk about The Light Between Oceans, starring Michael Fassbender. And I have trivia for you, by the way. Speaking of Michael Fassbender, don't answer now. We're going to hold this till the end. I'm going to play you an audio clip. Listeners, if you know the answer, you can tweet me at The Takeaway. If you think you know it, we might get your answer on the show. Michael Fassbender is starring in The Light Between the Oceans. Name this movie that features Michael Fassbender.
I say tell everyone everything. Why cover anything up, right?
Now, you might want to listen to his voice and the quality of his voice there. That's a hint. Rafer's thinking about it.
All right.
Let's go to Light Between the Oceans, directed by Derek, how do I pronounce that? Cianfrance?
Cianfrance.
Who directed The Place Between Beyond the Pines, which I loved.
Uh-huh, and also Blue Valentine.
Yeah.
So this is the story. Michael Fassbender plays a World War I veteran, shell-shocked, comes back to Australia. He wants to isolate himself in a lighthouse. He's going to work as a lighthouse keeper, the most isolated job he can find. He marries a woman there. They live together in the lighthouse. They can't conceive, but one day the tide brings in a dinghy that contains a perfectly healthy baby.
And this represents a major conflict.
This represents a major conflict. Also in the dinghy is a dead man. But the woman, played by Alicia Vikander, really wants this baby. So they decide to keep it, which clearly is not the right thing. And when they learn that the baby's mother is still out there looking for that baby 5 years later, things begin to kind of unravel.
The trailer here suggested a real rich sort of period piece feel, a lot of on-beach cinematography. It looked nice.
It's all shot in New Zealand and Australia. It looks beautiful. The cinematography is gorgeous. Fassbender is great. Vikander is great. Rachel Weisz, who plays the baby's real mother, great acting all the way around. Somehow, though, the story feels very contrived, and I just kind of couldn't get into it, and I wasn't sure what all this emotion and drama was really trying to tell me in the end. It's like a beautiful painting, but it didn't really seem like a work of art to me, if you know what I mean.
There's a bit of a sharp turn now to the sci-fi horror thriller Morgan,
yes,
which looked pretty cool to me. Now, this is about a corporate risk management consultant has to go back and decide whether to terminate a project.
Yes, that's an artificial intelligence, sort of an artificial life being. This risk management consultant, played by Kate Mara, refuses to call this thing a girl. It's played by Anya Taylor-Joy, plays Morgan. She won't call it a girl. She calls it an it, even though everyone else, all the scientists, the people who created her and made her alive, feel very familial, paternal toward her, even when she maims and kills them. they feel very warmly toward Morgan. And I love these kinds of movies. And this one is pretty good, but it really reminded me a lot of Blade Runner. And I kept wondering why it reminded me so much of Blade Runner. It's because Luke Scott is Ridley Scott's son. And I kept thinking, I don't know, I would have wanted a little more originality for my directorial debut, but it's still not a bad film.
And I got a couple of flavors off of Stranger Things when I watched the trailer. I don't know if that's right, but there is a project of a young girl who turns out to be more than she seems, and the adults around her are completely confused and befuddled by it. So I'm making a bit of a connection there. I make a connection to everything with Stranger Things. Let's get to trivia before I let you go. I asked you to name this film with Michael Fassbender.
I say tell everyone everything. Why cover anything up?
Rafer?
Right?
I'm stumped, Todd. Stumped.
That's Frank from 2014, where he was in the band with the Paper Mache.
A movie I love, by the way.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Sorry you didn't get it.
Me too.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick with another edition of Alien Invasion Theater.
Michael Rennie was ill the day the earth stood still, but he told us where we stand.
They come from Mars. They come from Andromeda. They come from the planet Transsexual in the galaxy of Transylvania. The aliens of Alien Invasion Theater are here. Is it the science fiction double feature? No, this time it's real life. Scientists with giant radio telescopes got excited earlier this week when they detected a spike in radio signals coming from deep space. Now, maybe they've backed off a little from that initial speculation that the signals could be extraterrestrial, but not before some obvious questions were raised, like what do those aliens want? What do they want to tell us? Most importantly, have they already seen the movies that we make about them?
So that's how you want to play it? Eat lead, alien robot! Evidently, they eat lead.
Well, lucky for us, Melissa Locker has been inspired by all of this and has come up with a little bit of an alien film festival for us. She's, of course, reporter for Time, The Guardian, and for us here at The Takeaway. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Todd.
So the number one alien contact movie is already got it in the title.
Contact.
I got it!
All right, let me hear it. Make me a liar, fish.
Jodie Foster plays a very serious, SETI scientist who wants nothing more in life than to make alien contact. So when a Russian radio telescope picks up a signal from outer space, which, yes, sounds exactly like what's happening right now, it turns out it truly is an alien life form trying to make contact.
It's also got great sort of like Tom Skerritt as the ethically compromised sort of senior political science guy. James Woods is in it. I mean, James Woods is always great.
Right. I mean, Matthew McConaughey playing a deep thinker, that is definitely worth watching. And it's just a fantastic movie that bears an eerie resemblance to real life. Perhaps Carl Sagan is actually a time traveler who knew something.
Speaking of time travel, we'll take it back to the late 70s and Richard Dreyfuss.
We have very little time, Mr. Neary. We need answers from you. They're honest, direct, and to the point.
Who are you people?
Avez-vous pas fait récemment une rencontre?
Have you recently had a close encounter?
I want to speak to someone in short.
Close encounter with something very unusual.
What the hell is going on around here?
Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind is kind of the classic alien movie. It's Richard Dreyfuss and a whole cast of incredible people, including Francoise Truffaut, strangely enough. Aliens come to Earth and they take a few people, sunburn a few people, and basically start a whole group of people headed towards Devil's Tower in the hopes of an alien encounter.
Steven Spielberg also co-opted the next generation of kids in the 80s with E.T.
E.T. Home phone.
You need to eat your Reese's Pieces and your Eggo waffles and watch E.T. and see these kids interact with an alien. And of course, the adults in the film are all pretty much bad news. It's only up to the kids to get this cute little adorable alien back to his home planet.
No, one of the things about all three of these films, Melissa, that you've named so far is that they all involve benign sort of alien forces. There's a lot of fear. You think they might be here to kill us or destroy the planet. War of the Worlds is a different story. Now, I'm bringing this one to the table, not the new version, the old version of War of the Worlds from the 50s, which was the original apocalyptic version of an alien contact.
Guns, tanks, bombs, they're like toys against them.
We know now that we can't beat their machines. Got to beat them.
Yeah, and I mean, that movie is purely haunting. Like, there's nothing good
happening.
Yeah, there's nothing good happening in that movie. I think it was when they did the radio drama that the whole country, like, shut down in fear that it was actually happening. And honestly, I don't mind the remake either. I thought it was terrifying as well.
I'm going to bring two more to the table just to make sure we round out this list a little bit. The Day the Earth Stood Still from, gosh, sometime in the early 50s. Not the Keanu Reeves version.
Klaatu Barada Nikto.
Yeah, a cautionary tale about human aggression, nuclear warfare, and our aggression on one another. I mean, his message was treat each other right or it's over for you.
Yeah, pretty much also the plot of Earth Girls Are Easy.
Oh, that's great. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention by the end of this the original alien, the man who fell to Earth, David Bowie. That movie disturbed me. I was too young when I saw it.
That and Brother from Another Planet, both. Do not watch those if you are too young. They will last you for the rest of your lives, haunting your memories.
And don't watch them back to back.
No, but do watch them with Eggos and Reese's Pieces.
Melissa Locker's culture reporter for Time, The Guardian, and The Takeaway here with her Alien Contact Film Festival. Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
Now and then you miss it. Sounds make you cry. Some nights you dance with tears in your eyes. I came to visit.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Of course, you're listening to Frank Ocean there. Frank Ocean dropped his latest album called Blonde about 2 weeks ago, and when he did it, it almost immediately shot to the top of the charts. Now, Ocean has enjoyed huge sales since then, but that's a lot less remarkable than how he released Blonde in the first place. Frank Ocean did not put out his album the way his record label, Def Jam, thought he was going to. Instead, Frank Ocean released the album independently, exclusively through Apple Music digital streaming. Now, Def Jam is part of Universal Music. Technically, Frank Ocean upheld his Universal contract by releasing a visual album 2 days earlier, then turned around and released Blonde independently, and thus cut the label out of a huge percentage of the album's profits. Forbes estimates he may have made as much as $1 million in the first week of sales. Now, Frank Ocean is not the first major artist to offer an exclusive release through a streaming service. Notably, Beyoncé's Lemonade made waves when it was released through Tidal. Larry Miller is a professor of music business at NYU Steinhardt and host of the Musonomics podcast, and he says streaming and new relationships between artists and their labels are completely upending the music business.
The means of production and distribution for many artists, especially artists at the top of the food chain, have become heavily democratized over the last decade in particular. And we're seeing that play out this year with the escalation of the music streaming wars.
It's hard to imagine how any lawyer at Def Jam, or for that matter Universal, wouldn't have seen this coming.
Yeah, the optics on this are not great for Universal, and we think largely as a result of the Frank Ocean move. Lucian Grange, the chairman of Universal, has put out an edict saying no more exclusives with streaming services for Universal Music Group artists.
To try to protect himself and try to protect the company from this happening again.
Presumably.
So Frank Ocean boosts his own bottom line here. He makes more money dealing with Apple Music than with Universal?
Yes, quite a lot more. Typically, if an artist is signed to a record company, in particular a major record company, they'll be paid in advance against a royalty rate. So rather than, say, a relatively, I don't want to say paltry, but certainly a sub-20% royalty rate, in this case, as the owner of the label, he would get all of the income from the iTunes sales and from those streams, which is more like 70%, assuming that he wrote 100% of the material.
So is there an object lesson here for artists across the spectrum? You said top of the food chain, but can this work for anyone who wants to operate in a new way and play hardball with a record company?
Well, theoretically, but there are still a bundle of very important services that record companies provide to artists. And the most precious commodity of all for most artists that I talk to is attention. If you're Frank Ocean and there is a huge amount of anticipation, you're in a pretty unique spot.
So we've seen other disputes like this in the very recent past. We've seen Taylor Swift's disputes with Spotify. Bands like Radiohead have circumvented the process entirely and put out records on their website. Fans pay what you want. It's clear the industry's changing and changing fast. How much has it changed, though, for people who aren't Frank Ocean or Taylor Swift or Radiohead?
There's no question that in the last several years, the availability of new technology and enormous audiences who have adopted that technology to discover and consume music has lowered the barrier of entry for almost any artist to be able to, at least theoretically, reach the platforms that could potentially attract a large global audience.
So that could be good for consumers. They might get more variety in their music. It's not controlled through these giant corporate record companies as much as it used to be. Maybe the idea of the old underground mixtape is coming back in a way, which is something I liked. But for the music consumer, since we're talking about Frank Ocean, is there any benefit for the listener for what he did?
There is more material released at the same time. I mean, this visual album, Endless, is actually pretty compelling. But the question here, I really think, is about the exclusivity deals that have been driven largely by Apple Music and also Tidal that have caused many superstar artists to align with one or another of those services exclusively in a way that is kind of anti-consumer. For example, if you're a premium subscriber to Spotify, you might not like it that that new Frank Ocean record is only available on Apple Music, although you may be induced to try that service as a result. But another knock-on effect of all of these exclusivity deals with superstar artists is that there is mounting evidence that piracy, that old bugaboo digital piracy, is being driven to new highs as a result of these exclusive deals.
Do we have any sympathies for Universal in this case, for what Frank Ocean did to them?
Well, it's hard to have sympathies for the major record companies in particular, but they are in a pretty tough position as a result of the growing strength and power and impact of the leading digital music services.
So if you are an artist who is on the cusp of hitting it big now and you've got the next big contract, you see what artists like Taylor Swift have done, what artists like Frank Ocean have done. You've seen the disputes between bands like Nine Inch Nails and record companies, or Tool and record companies. Tool hasn't put out an album in 10 years because of this nonsense. So what is the lesson here, even for the next big star, not the person playing in the coffee shop?
I think that for most working artists, this really isn't very relevant. They will continue to align themselves with record companies where it's useful to do so. And as important as the internet and all the digital music services are with respect to discovery and consumption of music, if you are in the pop or hip-hop genres in particular, and you want a number one record, in order to be validated by a huge global audience, the path to get there is still pop radio.
So you mentioned the CEO of Universal and sort of the new rules over there. What does the conversation look like this afternoon in the general counsel's office of Def Jam or any other record company out there who's looking at the situation and going, we didn't want this to happen again to us?
Let's lock down everything that isn't already locked down, number one. But number two, on the other side of the table, the artists and the managers and attorneys who are leading those discussions with the labels may use this as an opening in certain cases to renegotiate their deals.
Larry Miller, professor of music business at NYU and host of the Musonomics podcast on iTunes.
Indeed. iTunes is where to get it.
And walked off to look for America.
Well, this week, the immigration debate came raging back with a lot of noise and invective. But tune into The Takeaway on Monday for some of the real voices of immigration, the newest Americans who took the oath of citizenship. It all happened at historic Monticello Thomas Jefferson's residence in Charlottesville, Virginia.
And maybe I'm an inveterate optimist, but what stands out to me is if you look at public opinion polling, most Americans are embracing more immigration or keeping high levels of robust immigration the same, and embracing diverse immigration. Americans, much more, in 86, a vast majority of Americans were furious about the idea of legalizing those roughly 3 million undocumented immigrants. That's not so today.
You can hear a lot more from Monticello on Monday's show. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and automatically have our special Labor Day show delivered right to your device. Again, find us on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. In the meantime, you can always follow me on Twitter. I'm at Todd Zwillick. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.
Over an open field. Kathy, I'm lost, I said, though I knew she was sleeping. I'm empty and aching, and I don't know.
PRI, Public Radio International.